home of the stars through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I am Rob Watson, and tonight we have a timely and important show for you. We are going to talk about net neutrality, which the FCC met today and in a very partisan way have threatened the net neutrality, which is a very unpopular move, but they did it anyway, and it is in the interest of big business, the 1%, and we're going to uncouple that, figure out who wins, who loses, and most importantly, what it means to the LGBTQ community. Tonight, commentary will be from our very small, shortened panel, which is normally filled with lots of our top journalists. And today, we have the one, the only, Brody Levesque. Brody, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate that.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you. We have on deck an activist, very key in the fight against the removal of net neutrality, and we're going to talk to her in a minute. Brody, you want to give us a little framework of what's been going on?
Over the past couple of months, the FCC has indicated that they were going to remove the restrictions on corporate and large companies of internet service providers on what we call shifting it from a Title I to a Title II, which sounds kind of wonky, but what it essentially did was it leveled the playing field. It meant that internet service providers, particularly the large companies such as Verizon, would not be able to throttle and choke off and set up fast lanes and slow lanes for companies, for internet users, everything from streaming to videos to even web traffic itself. The chairman of the FCC, however, is a former corporate lawyer for Verizon, and he, no shock, decided that they needed to move back to the way that they claim worked best for the internet, which were the rules that were put into place in 1996. And worked until 2015 when, under the Obama administration, they changed it. I guess the easiest way to explain this to the listener is that under the rules that were instituted in 2015, or net neutrality, the FCC treated the internet and its companies as a public service utility. In other words, it was something that could be regulated the same way water or power, any kind of, you know, utility would be function. And it really did, in fact, level the playing field. That meant that from the smallest creator and the smallest entity of business, could be a mom and pop mail order business, all the way up to the huge super giants like Facebook, Google, and everybody else, everybody had to compete and everybody had to, you know, play nice in a sandbox. Chairman Pai's argument, along with Commissioner Carr and Commissioner O'Reilly, the other two Republican majority members of the commission, was that this stifled creativity, it stifled freedom, it made it impossible for companies to be innovative, it made it impossible for infrastructure to be developed because you were strangling, you know, the money that it would take to invest in this, which is not true. It's patently false. I'll let Carly explain that a little bit more in detail. Today's vote by the FCC more or less returned to the what most people that I've talked to that, you know, are very much advocates of net neutrality, the bad old days. And it just simply means that if you don't have a whole bunch of money, you're going to be squeezed out by your large corporate competitors. And it's inherently unfair. For the consumer, it really does mean that there is a very distinct probability that if you want to have YouTube and access to this and access to that and stream on Netflix, Hulu, and all these other things that you could end up, you know, purchasing packages just like what you would do for cable. It really would be that bad. So this is not a vote, really. And the other thing that kind of got everybody upset, this wasn't a vote that needed to happen. This was another case of Republican small government thinking and philosophy run amok. And there was also undue pressure from the Trump administration and the White House itself to do this. So this really has created an uncertain environment. Now, and Carly will tell you this when she gets on, this FCC vote today, while it's really bad, it isn't the end of it. There is a way to power the FCC down, and that is to have Congress do it. And I'm sure that the bulk of our discussion this evening will be about that. So that's a basic synopsis of what happened. I also have statements from two state attorney generals that whose offices I communicated with today. There are 18 states attorney generals who are opposing what the FCC did today. The state attorney general of Oregon, Ellen F. Rosenblum, and these are the states of California, Oregon, Delaware, Hawaii, Iowa, Illinois, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Maryland, Maine, Mississippi, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, the Commonwealth of Virginia, Vermont, and Washington State. And one of the number one things that they're also concerned about, in addition to the playing field being taken away, is the fact that a lot of the commentary during the time period to comment on this particular thing, there was a plethora of fraudulent comments being made, and some of them were coming in from Russian bots. And the attorney generals of both Oregon and New York are saying, hey, wait, stop. How can you vote on something where we have evidence of fraudulent commentary going on? And New York went one step further and said, look, some of these comments were identity theft. These are U.S. citizens that never made these comments. So how can you do this?
Can you, Brody, I'm following you on the comments. The comments were made where?
The FCC had opened up for people to comment in on the proposal for the rollback, okay, during, the FCC has several mechanisms in place, public hearings, public commentary, and other things. They chose not to do public hearings. What they did instead was open up for comments. The problem was so many comments were made, there's well over 2 million and some change, but the problem was a lot of these comments in the FCC's site were fraudulently placed. And this was a complaint that was being made by the state attorney general on behalf of the consumers of their states.
Got it. Well, okay. Let's bring on Carly so we can open up the discussion there. Carly Stevenson is a campaigner with Demand Progress, and Demand Progress is a leading internet freedom and digital rights group with over 2 million affiliated activists. So, and Carly's got extensive experience, including working for the Bernie Sanders campaign. So without further ado, we want to welcome Carly to the show. Carly, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, thank you for being on. And I can imagine you are on pins and needles today.
Yeah, today was a pretty rough day. Obviously, it went the way we expected it to, but obviously hoped it wouldn't. But the fight is definitely not over, and there are a number of different mechanisms that we're going to be using to defend new net neutrality and defend the open internet order and to roll back this terrible repeal that the FCC has done.
I applaud you for your work and everything you're doing. Can you, Brody gave us some perspective on why this is a bad thing. From your perspective, what does this rollback mean for the population in general and the LGBTQ community specifically?
Sure. Well, I think from the broadest perspective, obviously, I think, you know, the internet has completely revolutionized how people work, how people get their education, how people create, you know, make music, make art, how people connect with other like-minded people, whether they are gamers or members of the LGBT community or like to collect watches and everything in between. And so I think that the largest danger is that, you know, all the all those different communities and places online that are part of the big internet ecosystem have flourished under an internet that is open and free and where all traffic is treated the same by internet service providers, which is net neutrality. That is the principle of net neutrality. And so really, when you hand over the internet to a few monopolistic cable companies and internet service providers, you basically put all that in jeopardy. So now everybody who uses the internet is in danger of having their internet bill go up, because now cable and internet companies have the ability to create paid prioritization, create fast lanes and slow lanes, and to say, hey, if you want to access this certain site, then you have to pay us more. They now have the ability to say, you know what? We don't like that site. We're going to block it, just straight out block it and not allow our customers to see that site. Or they can do things like throttling and say, hey, you know, if I'm company A and I have a lot of money and I want to get a leg up on my competitor, I can pay my ISP to throttle down or slow down my competitor's website. So without net neutrality, all of those things are on the table, and all of those things are things that cable and internet companies will now have the ability to do. And I think what is of particular concern to the LGBT community, as well as other marginalized communities, is that the internet has completely revolutionized how people come to understand themselves as LGBTQ, and also how we connect with one another and how we advocate for our own interests. So, you know, when I was just coming to figure out that I was a lesbian, you know, I was in junior high, and my options were, you know, there was a little paper on a bulletin board at my local library that said, you know, Seacoast Outright, and it was a local youth group. And I would read all 5 books about, like, being a young gay kid in the library. And that's basically it, right? I didn't have, you know, this was back when it was dial-up, right? I didn't have access to a whole world of people like me. Now young people who are just coming out and just figuring out who they are, now they have access to a whole world online because of the internet. And I think, obviously, they're in our fight for marriage equality, in our fight for, you know, all the different rights that we have, the internet has been an enormous part of that. And so if activists have to worry about, you know, paying more, or worried that what they're saying is something that the cable companies don't like, you know, that really puts all of our activism in serious jeopardy.
Very astute rundown there of the situation. I wanted to ask a question of probably both of you. Brody described that the net neutrality rules came in under the Obama administration. What was the situation prior to Obama coming in? In other words, was there a reason why a lot of the horrific competitiveness and opportunistic things that could have happened, is there a reason that didn't happen before Obama that it might now happen?
So there were rules from 2010 that had prohibitions on blocking and on fast lanes and unreasonable discrimination, and those were actually weaker. And the reason why we fought so hard to get the 2015 Open Internet Order in place is that those rules from 2010 they were attacked legally by Verizon. And a federal court actually ruled that those kinds of rules in terms of not allowing blocking, not allowing fast lanes, or discrimination, that those could only be put in place by the FCC if internet service providers were reclassified as common carriers, right? So meaning like if they were treated essentially the same way as like the phone company. So we had to have this open internet order in order for the FCC to have the power to ensure that internet service providers don't violate net neutrality principles. And there's a huge long list. And the thing is that what the internet service providers will tell you is that, oh, we don't block, we don't throttle, we don't do those things. But there is a huge long list of instances where ISPs have violated net neutrality. They've violated it repeatedly over the years. And that's why we have to have these rules in place. If we didn't have these rules, it would just be a free-for-all. It's not as though this is not a solution in search of a problem. This is something that the ISPs have very clearly stated that they want to do, that they have tried to do in the past, and that they absolutely will do in the future if given the opportunity, which is why we have to keep fighting to roll back this repeal.
Well,
I think the other part of this, too, is that we have to look at the fact, and I'm building on what Carly just said, that in today's speech he made before the commission, before the vote, Chairman Pai kept making reference to, oh, we're going to hand it back to the Federal Trade Commission. They should have the teeth for the enforcement, and they should be able to do that, which is very disingenuous. This is not about trade practices. This is not about in the marketplace in that way. He's deflecting off of the regulatory power that the FCC does, in fact, have. His claim today of, well, we're going to give it back to the FTC like it was before, is very disingenuous, bordering right on fabrication. Go ahead, Rob.
Oh, no. I was listening. The internet now, over the past few years, has grown with certain mammoth social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, those things. How will the content in those platforms be effective, or will they at all?
I can answer that from my perspective as a journalist. Carly, you may want to answer that as an activist. As a journalist, I can tell you that the ISPs will look at anything that consumes large and vast amounts of data, such as Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Hula, Netflix, any platform that needs to data munch, is what my engineers tell me, and they're going to want to charge more money or fast lane that, or slow lane it, depending upon how they're structured. What that translates into in the marketplace is if you're, say, a customer of Cox Communications, they're one of the largest internet service providers in the United States. So you're a Cox customer. Now, if you want to buy cable from Cox, they have a tiered priced packaging system. You can get HBO and Stars and all this other rubbish with so many channels for this price a month plus your internet. Well, if this goes through, and what Carly is basically saying and what I'm agreeing with, is that Cox now would also be able to charge you extra because you're going to be using Facebook a lot, you're going to be using YouTube a lot, you're going to be using Instagram a lot, and now suddenly you're going to be consuming vast amounts of data, so we're going to charge you an extra $5 or $6 a month in a package in order to do that. The other flip side of that is that, as Carly pointed out, okay, you also are going to have certain sites that won't obviously be quite as competitive, and the ISP is either going to be able to shut them off or slow them down to the point where if a consumer logs on, you get the little circle thing spinning and around and around and around from hell, and sooner or later, you know, customers are going to say, well, screw this. Hey, you know, this goes back to the dial-up days. I'm just going to go find something that's quicker. The net effect of that, pardon the pun, is that a consumer is not going to be able to have fair access and equitable equal access, because that will be determined by the corporate zoot suits wherever these corporations are, such as Verizon. Carly, you want to pick it up from there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing to keep in mind, I mean, so obviously for us as an activist organization, you know, our primary concern is how does net neutrality affect, you know, how does net neutrality affect activists? How does net neutrality people engage? How does the repeal of net neutrality affect people who are engaging in political speech, in you know, small businesses, artists, creators? You know, those are the folks that we're primarily concerned about. But it's important to remember that many of the violations that ISPs have committed against net neutrality over the years have actually been against very large platforms. So, for instance, from 2011 to 2013, AT&T, Sprint, and Verizon all blocked Google Wallet, which is a mobile payment system. Many of your listeners may have used it. Because it competed with a similar service that they had and that all three companies had a stake in developing. You know, in 2012, AT&T announced that they were going to disable the FaceTime video, the FaceTime app on its customers' iPhones unless they subscribe to a more expensive text and voice plan. So it's actually, you know, not just about the little guys, even though that's obviously the people that are the most in danger and the people that we're most concerned about. But if you look at all the different ways that ISPs have maneuvered and have tried to, you know, violate net neutrality for their own purposes, it has certainly included other large platforms. So really, it's kind of anybody's guess, you know, what an internet service provider might do at any given time. So no platform should think that they are somehow safe, no matter how much money they have, from what internet service providers may think at any given moment is going to help their bottom line the most.
True. Very true.
Will there be any potential of counter-marketing by somebody getting in there being innovative? Let's say this goes through, who offers to consumers, if you sign up with us, we will provide in a private way net neutrality. We will give you access to all these other sites that you can't get if you're going through Verizon, et cetera, et cetera. Is there a possibility of that, or would this even shut down that kind of true free market?
So I think the problem is, and so one of the major issues and one of the reasons why net neutrality is so important is the fact we're talking about monopolies here. In many, many places, people have only one choice for cable and internet, and it's very, very difficult to start new internet. You know, it takes a lot of capital, it takes a lot of investment, and there are also lots of legal mechanisms that can be used to kind of that and are used to sort of keep those monopolies in place. So I think that the reality is that it's not a free market now. And many people don't have many options at all. So I think that would be very difficult. And I think that's one of the major arguments in favor of net neutrality is that you cannot allow companies that already have in many places an effective monopoly on this market to then have more power about what is allowed to go through those pipes and at what speed.
Well,
I think
before we went,
go ahead,
Brody. No, go ahead.
Well, okay. I think the other problem too is that in addition to that, you know, Chairman Pai again was being a little disingenuous here, and not just in today's hearing before the vote, but also over the last couple of months as these discussions have been going on, because he's been consistently maintaining that there would have to be a rollback in order for these companies to be able to expand, you know, broadband and to be able to implement new forms of, you know, internet into communities that may not previously have that. That's not exactly true. And as Carly just pointed out, one of the other biggest problems that is out there is the fact that there are limited options for consumers. And nearly anyone that I have talked to that works in that field, and especially in the technology field, they've all said the same thing. There is an absolute almost lack of competition that actually needs to be addressed by more oversight, not less oversight. You have areas of the United States that are not served at all by broadband communications, and there's no reason for it. And you've got other areas where, as Carly pointed out, they're monopolies. You know, when you look at the companies that have the most amount of control, you're essentially looking at two: Universal, Comcast, Xfinity, and Cox Communications. That's it. Those are your two heavyweights. A vast amount of internet traffic travels through those companies' servers. So they have the potential for creating all sorts of mischief. In addition, they also can block, just by simply saying, well, we don't have enough money, efforts for investment or reinvestment into building infrastructure out into areas of the United States that currently don't have access to the internet. Go ahead, Rob.
Brody, I wanted to actually go to, you had some statements from different attorney generals around the country.
I spoke to the attorney general's offices of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the state of New York, and the state of Oregon. The biggest problem that these attorney generals are looking at is the fact that they honestly, truly feel that the commentary process was corrupted. Let me read from what the New York State Attorney General, A.G. Snyderman, said. Okay, I'm not going to read his whole statement, but I'm just going to read this one part. Millions of fake comments have corrupted the FCC public process, including 2 million that stole the identities of real people, which is a crime under New York State law. Yet the FCC is moving full steam ahead with a vote based on this corrupted process while refusing to cooperate with an investigation. As we've told the FCC, moving forward with this vote would make a mockery of our public comment process and reward those who perpetuated this fraud to advance their own hidden agenda. The FCC must postpone this vote and work with us to get to the bottom of what happened. Well, after the vote was taken, the Attorney General's office said, fine, then we're probably just going to have to sue them. From the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, State Attorney General Josh Shapiro had this: the vote by the FCC to gut net neutrality could end the internet as we know it. The FCC action undermines free speech and is bad for consumers and businesses, especially startups and small businesses. With 17 of my colleague attorneys general, I called on the FCC to delay today's vote to allow state and federal investigations to continue into the more than 1 million fake comments that were sent to the FCC about net neutrality. This huge number includes tens of thousands of fake comments issued under the names of real Pennsylvanians. The theft of someone's voice in our democracy cannot stand, and we must first get to the bottom of this massive identity theft. I plan to take legal action along with my fellow attorneys general to protect net neutrality, and we believe that the FCC's decision will now face serious legal challenges. From the Attorney General of Oregon, and I'm just basically going to make her statement's very similar to the other two, but there's one thing that she said. This: as a state attorney general, many of our offices across Oregon have received complaints from consumers indicating their distress over their names being used in such a manner. We will take serious action to review these consumer complaints through our processes. However, we're urging the commission to take immediate action and to cooperate with all law enforcement investigations, both state and federal. One of the biggest parts in the contention during this entire process over the last few months, as evidenced by these statements from these state attorney generals, is the fact that the process itself was open to fraud. This basically runs along the same lines as what happened with the election process, And in some cases, I'm being told by federal investigators there were definitely Russian bots involved. The state's attorney generals of these 18 states, are saying this process is fraudulent. So it's not just activists like Carly that are saying this is fraudulent and detrimental. We've got, you know, 18 of the states saying, hey, look, this isn't right. And in addition to the two Democratic members of the SEC themselves who indicated they weren't happy with it. What we saw today during that hearing, and I watched all of it from start to finish, including the 35-minute sponsored break, but, I mean, what we saw today was three members of the commission who are absolutely tone-deaf to not only these state attorney generals, but to the entire process. So it's more than just not listening. This goes above and beyond this. And this is of real concern. In speaking to these law enforcement officials, they're saying, hey, look, you know, our consumers are calling us and saying, but wait, that's not what we think, that's not what we feel. You know, in a polling that was done by the Gallup organization about, I think, a week before this vote was actually taken, the percentage was skewed well over 80% of Americans saying we want net neutrality to stay in place. 80%. Now, other polls have it from 67%. Some have it at 70%. So if we take all the polls and we just average them out, I'm going to stick with 78% of Americans are not real happy campers tonight after this FCC vote. Carly?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, this is and always has been a very bipartisan, transpartisan issue. And the number of different constituencies and people online that have come together to fight this repeal, many of them using tools from a site that we run along with two other internet organizations, Free Press and Fight for the Future, called battleforthenet.com. They're everyone from Etsy to, you know, everyone from Etsy to Kickstarter, Twitter, lots of the big players to, you know, websites like MetalSucks.com and, you know, Chess.com, right? So, you know, sites that are, you know, and then civil rights organizations, ACLU, Center for Media Justice, really across the gamut, you know, kind of almost every constituency that you can think of that uses the internet to communicate with each other or to come together in a common on a common interest understands the value of net neutrality. And this has never been, it's never been a partisan issue. It's always been basically, you know, as we like to say, team internet versus team cable. The only people that are happy tonight are, you know, like Verizon and AT&T and Comcast lobbyists and like, you know, the big shareholders of these companies. Nobody else wanted this. And so it absolutely is. And I think it's important just to piggyback on what Brody was saying. It's very clear that from the get-go, Ajit Pai's goal and the members of the commission who supported this repeal, they never intended for this process to be fair and open and even-handed. They have purposely sort of allowed this process to become contaminated so that people don't trust it and they can just throw their hands up and say, well, who really knows? I mean, who can say what the American people want? So we're gonna do this because you know it's gonna help innovation. And I want to just jump to that real quick because that's actually something, you know, what you will hear over and over and over again from Ajit Pai and from his supporters in Congress and from the other two commissioners, Carr and O'Reilly, is that they want that the whole reason to repeal net neutrality is to bridge the digital divide and to spur investment in broadband in underserved areas and to make broadband better and to help people. And I want to make it very, very clear to your listeners that net neutrality and the digital divide, the net neutrality does not cause the digital divide. And if anything, people who experience poor access to the internet now, that is only going to get worse without net neutrality. But this is not – ending net neutrality will do nothing to bridge the digital divide. And in fact, in the last 2 years, investment in expanding broadband networks has actually gone up. What the ISPs do is they say one thing to the FCC and they cry in front of the cameras and the media and say, oh, we have no money. We can't help these poor people in rural areas that don't have access to broadband. And that's all we want to do is help them, but we can't. We have no money to invest. And then they turn around and they tell their investors, they admit to their own investors that that Title II, that having internet service, having broadband being classified under Title II has not harmed their investments at all. It has nothing to do with their plans. And in fact, for many of these ISPs, their investments have gone up in the past 2 years. So basically they're talking out of both sides of their mouth because they know that saying, hey, we want to have another way to make even more money off of consumers largely who are beholden to us and don't have any choices anyway, they know that's not really going to fly, so they make up the canard of the lack of investment, which is just not borne out by the facts at all.
Right.
Can
you explain the digital divide a little more for people who are not aware of what that concept is?
Sure. So the digital divide basically refers to there are many parts of this country that either have no access to high-speed internet at all or very, very little access. So these are largely rural areas, but they also include, areas of urban areas that are usually generally poor and disproportionately affect communities of color. So there are a lot of people in this country who, if you live in a well-to-do metropolitan area, you have great access to the internet, right? You have access to high-speed broadband. You probably have access to several different speeds. If you want to pay more, so you can, game or run a website out, whatever it is, you can do that. And then there are other people who, don't have access to the internet at all. So that's really what the digital divide is the folks that have access to high-speed internet, most of whom are in sort of the greater metropolitan areas, wealthy suburbs, and then rural areas and, urban areas that tend to be lower income and disproportionately neighborhoods and communities of color. So when we talk about the digital divide, that's what we talk about, and it has a real impact. If you look at, like, for instance, kids who go to school, 70%, I think, is, if I remember correctly, the number, 70% of teachers in our country assign homework and projects and papers that require access to the internet. And a lot of kids in rural areas in particular, they don't have access outside of school, or they're hanging out like at the McDonald's late at night trying to, catch the Wi-Fi signal. And so that obviously is having a huge impact on those kids' ability to learn versus kids in, say, the wealthy suburbs that have lightning-fast internet in their homes.
So thank you for going into that, because I think it's important to lay that framework for people who are not as versed as you guys are. So let me ask a theoretical question. That assuming that this does go through very much in an unpopular way with the majority of America not for it, we are successful in shaking out potentially Congress in the next election and Trump in the election after that, and some saner voices get in there. What disruption... I guess my question is, isn't this a really risky business for those who would want to profit off that this very quickly could be completely dismantled in the next wave, and some huge investments could go right down the toilet?
I think looking at it realistically, the problem that these internet service providers are going to run into, particularly companies like Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, and some of the others, Sprint included, is that they're going to run right into what I call a consumer pain point. You know, consumers are odd creatures of habit, and if they get to a certain point that they have certain expectations, and then that's ripped out from underneath them, there's a direct bouncing back effect on them. And I think that these companies will understand in a very negative way, and quite frankly, probably a very partisan way, that there's only so much that they can do. Net neutrality has been an incredibly popular regulatory oversight and effort since it was instituted 2 years ago, and that's borne out by the facts. It's incredibly popular not only with consumers but within the companies themselves. And yeah, Carly's absolutely correct. A lot of these large corporations like Verizon and AT&T do literally talk out both sides of their mouth. But there's one fact that's, you know, cannot be disputed. Because the open internet rule went into effect to level the playing field, it succeeded. Suddenly, if consumers get directly impacted by this and certain things with that level of expectation is suddenly altered, I think it'll be slightly more than just a ballot box when it comes back to the blowback on this. I may be wrong. But one of the things I wanted to ask...
No, I think you're right. What will that blowback look like? I think you're absolutely right. I think there'll be an explosion of whatever way people can blow back. But what would that look like?
Well, I know that Carly and her fellow activist community, and there are some very powerful figures in there. We're talking more than just non-governmental nonprofits. We're also talking lawmakers, attorney generals of states, consumer advocacy bureaus, consumer advocacy groups, are going to be putting a tremendous amount of pressure on these companies. And I think that the minute they start getting really unfair, there's a couple of avenues that can be done. I was told today by a lawyer for the Communications Project of the American Civil Liberties Union that there are a variety of remedies that could be applied legally. So in other words, you know, Pi today was saying, well, we're going to hand it back to the FCC and we're going to, or FTC, and we're going to hand it back here and there, and there'll be other ways of taking care of it. Well, in an odd way, he's opening that up for litigation. So that's one possible remedy. I think the other part of it, and Carly can speak to this, but from my point of view as a journalist covering the activist community, my assumption is going to be there will be boycotts. There will probably be disruptions. We've already seen I call them the hacktivists, the anonymous people, have threatened to, you know, take action against companies and start treating the least of these very unfairly. Economically, I think it would also cause some problems, because what will end up happening is once people understand the level to which they're actually being impacted by this poor reversal by the FCC, and then you have these ISPs and these other companies taking advantage of that, it's kind of a Newton's law. You know, it's the law of gravity. What's up comes down, and it goes in one spot. So we're going to find that out. But I think that it's going to be more of an organized effort, albeit it'll be very difficult if these ISPs decide they want to throttle websites or block them and things like that. But with the platforms like Twitter and text and everything else that the activist community uses in addition to the web, I think they're in for a really, really rough ride. The point of attack for a lot of this, though, will be, in fact, Congress. And the ironic thing here is that in many ways, this is a very bipartisan issue. Republicans like Pi, who advocate for less regulation and less government, less restrictions, they have an Achilles heel. And that is that they can be directly affected and hoisted on their own petard by consumers and other people because of the fact that they're not seeing how they're going to get impacted until they really are. And this, we're talking in the bottom line, you know, in this case being, you know, all wealthy individual. Carly, you want to speak to that?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the first thing is, and I want to really emphasize this because obviously when things like this happen, it's very disheartening and it's easy to feel like, okay, net neutrality was repealed today. It's over. We have to wait until, you know, the next election to be able to change this. And that's definitely not true. Our next step in this fight is we are going to be doing a full court press and mobilizing activists across the country in every single state, mobilizing voters, constituents, to contact their senators and their representatives and ask them to support a CRA of net neutrality. So CRA stands for Congressional Review Act, which enables Congress to review any rule that is made by any government regulatory agency within 60 legislative days, and they can roll it back. So our plan, what we are doing is we're calling on the Senate and Congress to take action through the Congressional Review Act and just roll this rule back. And so we are going to be making, that's going to be where we're focusing our efforts over the coming weeks and months, is to get the votes that we need in order to just use that mechanism to simply roll this back. There are also going to be challenges in court. So this particular battle is over. This particular round is over, but we are definitely not done fighting. And I think that, you know, we saw even in just the last week a number of Republican congressmen come out against the repeal. And I think that as these members of Congress hear from more and more of their constituents about how unhappy they are with this repeal, I think that we're going to be able to build more and more support for a CRA to just roll this back. And I think that we've seen this before where a lot of members of Congress, you know, they don't understand how important something is to their constituents, and then suddenly they're getting thousands of phone calls and they think, oh, geez, you know, maybe I want to back off a little bit on this because I've got people banging down my door. So that's what we're going to be focusing on, is getting folks to contact their representatives and their senators to support this CRA. It's already been filed by both in the House and the Senate. That's our main focus. And then I think obviously, you know, there are other avenues, as Brody said as well.
I know Kamala Harris out here in California has a petition already going. She's seeking to get it up to at least 1 million signatures. Will that go to those efforts, or is that another way around it that she's looking to establish?
Yeah, so I haven't seen that particular petition, but I imagine that it's probably in support of reversing the repeal, but Brody probably knows more about that than I do.
Well, actually, no, that's an independent effort by California's junior senator. The problem, as you mentioned, is getting both the Senate and the House Oversight Committees to do it. In the Senate, you've got a little bit of a tougher fight. The Senate Commerce Committee oversees the FCC. Its chairman is South Dakota Senator John Thune. And this guy has praised, you know, the very ground that PI works on. So there's going to be an uphill fight in the Senate. The House Oversight Committee is going to be a little different because the House has been, the Oversight Committee there is Energy and Commerce, and they've taken a little bit more of a jaded view on it. And I think that what Carly's saying is correct. The next push to get Congress within these next 60 legislative days to roll this back after the Christmas break will probably be the way to go. Now, there won't probably be a tremendous amount of interference from the White House. There could be, you know, some of the usual nonsensical tweets coming out of the Oval Office, but we've come to expect that, at least from him. I think the big push here is going to be coming to get these two committees to have some sort of agreement and push through this legislative effort. Carly's right. I've spoken to a couple of offices today, and there is actual bipartisan support for this, and including from a couple of unlikely sources, even on the House side in the Freedom Caucus. They do see this as a little bit of an overstep by the SEC. The biggest part of the problem here that I keep hearing from the Hill, and I've even heard it from a source at the White House, believe it or not, is that Chairman Pai has basically rammed this thing through and hasn't listened to anyone. So not only do you have the controversy over all the fake comments and all the nonsense with that, there's been no public hearings on this. There's been no real transparency in this. It's just been ram this thing through and that's it, and this is how we want it. It just is not going to work out too well for him. You know, he has constantly been a critic of the FCC even before he joined it as a commissioner. Now, ironically, he has also worked in the Office of the General Counsel between 2007 and 2011 for the FCC. He was deputy general counsel. So he did have, in fact, supervisory responsibility. So it's not as if Chairman Pai doesn't understand the larger picture here of the landscape. This is strictly partisan politics at its absolute worst. This guy is an absolute Republican zealot when it comes down to conservative politics, and he's tone deaf. So if the listeners out there and the public want to do something, they need to support the efforts that Carly's talking about and that the junior senator from California is taking to make Congress really aware that they are very dissatisfied with today's vote and they want the damn thing rolled back. Carly, who would they – let's talk about you for just a second, your organization. I mean, how are you structured, and what can you guys do for the public, and how do they get a hold of you?
Sure. So the best thing that listeners can do if they want to get more involved in this fight, so my organization is called Demand Progress, and the best thing that they can do is go to our website, which is battleforthenet.com, and battleforthenet.com is basically your one-stop shop for all things related to net neutrality activism. You can write to your member of Congress there. You can learn more about how to get involved. And, you know, we don't just have the work we've been doing. It hasn't just been all online. We've actually been running a really robust organizing program with lots of volunteers across the country who've been doing peer-to-peer texting and turning people out to events, turning people out to scheduled meetings with members of Congress. So there's lots of ways to get involved beyond, you know, making a phone call or calling in. And I would encourage anyone who's passionate about this issue, and especially if you have some time on your hands, we're going to need a lot of folks on deck to really mobilize the number of people that we're going to need to mobilize over the next few months in order to get this rollback. So battleforthenet.com, that will tell you everything that you need to know to get more involved in this fight. And I would just absolutely encourage everyone who's listening to get involved and to make their voices heard, because this really is an issue that I think is going to impact our community and impact how we can fight for our own issues. And I think that it's going to be those marginalized communities that are the most impacted in a negative way by the repeal of net neutrality.
Completely agree. I just wanted to add one thing. At the request of the State Attorney General's Office for the State of New York and the other Attorney General's offices I spoke to today, if you live in the following states, California, the District of Columbia, Delaware, Hawaii, Iowa, Illinois, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Maryland, Maine, Mississippi, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, the Commonwealth of Virginia, Vermont, and Washington State, please check and make sure that your name has not been fraudulently used in the public comment section for the FCC. You can call your state's attorney generals or get a hold of them by email, and they can help you out with that. They have a helpline. If you want to talk to your senator or your representative in Congress, the Capitol Switchboard, write this number down, folks. It's area code 202-224-3121. That's area code 202-224-3121. When you get to Capitol Switchboard, you have an automated voicemail there that you can dial up by name, or you can press zero and talk to the very nice ladies at the Capitol operators, and they will connect you to your representative. I might add, you may want to Google just to make sure that you've got the name before you do it, Rob.
Yeah, you both mentioned that this is a potentially a bipartisan issue. How is this going to play out within the Republican Party? Who are the proponents and who are the opponents, and how will they get leverage? Trump has not come out and to date, and I'm not saying he won't, and I'm not saying it won't be bizarre, but he hasn't weighed in on this himself specifically yet, has he?
The president has not specifically addressed it in such a way as to make it, anything, as a blip on the radar screen. He has praised Pai previously, and of course he was the one that appointed him to his term as FCC chair. But to the best of my knowledge, we haven't heard much from the White House on net neutrality, although that will probably change. I'm sure tomorrow my colleagues in the briefing room will probably be pegging the press secretary about this issue as well, because the vote occurred about the same time as today's briefing, and I don't know whether or not any of my colleagues hit her for that today. There were other issues they were more interested in. But no, to the best of my knowledge, I haven't heard anything from the White House. Carly?
I have not. Donald Trump Jr. did tweet today about it. said that he would pay good money to hear if anyone who's all worked up about net neutrality can even explain it or even heard about it before this week. And I just wanted to be like, buddy, you have not spent that much time on the internet, obviously. but no, I don't think he has come out and said much about it. But I imagine that as we get ramped up and as more and more people get tuned into how dangerous and detrimental this is, I think that we'll see him doing what he's done in the past, which is when things start to not go his way and there starts to get pushback, he'll start to, put the crazy tweets out there to kind of, misdirect people and change the story. So I'm sure that we will see that happening
very soon, I bet. Yeah. Carly, I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight. We are down to our last 60 seconds. And thank you for your work. And I hope people take heed and get involved and carry this through. Brody, thank you as always. To our listeners, thank you for listening. We will be back next week, Thursday, same time, 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time, and you can figure out the time zones in between. Also listen to Out in Santa Cruz on Saturday night, 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time on www.ksdo.com. We will have a fantastic show for you there as well. We look forward to talking to you again. Get out there, be active. Let's change the world. Thanks, folks. Good night.